Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Director Product Marketing at Backblaze, Skip Livens.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Skip. Welcome to the show. It's going to be lot of fun. I must divulge to the listeners that we've known each other for maybe 15 years or at least. Both at worked least. At Apple together, and we have a lot to talk about. So just to fill the listeners in, you are currently the Director of Product Marketing at Backblaze, the cloud storage and backup company. You've been driving product marketing, technology evangelism, and brand marketing since 1993. You're a former Marine, former Apple employee, yay, in developer relations. And you've worked extensively on storage at Quantum, active storage startup, Simply with Alex Grossman, and now Backblaze. Boy, that's quite a career.
Yes, indeed. In fact, you know, it's interesting looking back on that to think about that intersection of Apple and storage and all the things that Apple taught, if you were there in those rough and tumble years, about how to build a great product and how to build an experience for a user. And largely my career has been taking those lessons and implementing them all over the place. So yes, you and I do have a lot of shared experience. And
we're going to talk about all that as we progress into the show. But as I do, and in this case, it's going to be particularly interesting because we've known each other for so long, but I only know you starting at Apple in the early aughts. And I've never really had a chance to hear about your early years and your background. So tell me how you got started and tell me how you got into computers when you were younger.
Well, you know, a popular question is, what was your first computer? And, you know, I want to say Apple, but
for a lot of people, it's an Atari.
Exactly. But the Apple II, for whatever reason, I just thought was too niche. And the computer that just seized my imagination was a Commodore 64.
Oh, yeah.
There was a library of them at Berkeley High School where I graduated, and it's almost like every other class I had, you know, Latin, whatever, just faded away, and all I cared about was the computer class. I had been to the labs to go do, you know, where they bring a school in to do Unix time sharing on the big, you know, the big Unix systems where you type into the terminal. That was interesting, but nothing seized my imagination like something that felt like a personal computer, like the Commodore 64. You could write your own programs. You could, you know, we wrote our own games, and then of course I tore apart all the hard drives and tried to figure out, you know, how the floppy drives worked and all that.
Did it have bitmap graphics like the Apple II, so you could access high resolution graphics from BASIC?
Yeah, absolutely, and BASIC. You know, I remember even then thinking that BASIC was interesting, but it seemed like the elegant things were really hard or impossible. So as I started becoming aware of other programming languages later, it really just accelerated from there.
So then at some point you joined the Marines. I'm curious about what you did there.
I did. So I went to San Jose State. Nominally going after an advertising and marketing degree. But as I was at the same time, while I was holding down multiple jobs to pay for that education, I said, you know what I need to do is also do the Marines OCS program. So on top of everything else, between my sophomore and junior years, off I went to Quantico, Virginia. And there I got introduced to the Marines and graduated from that and learned that that I had a hard date when I had to finish school in order to be commissioned. Well, long story short, trying to meet that deadline was really tough, working two or three jobs. And I said, so I actually got out of that program, vowing to get back in the Marines later. Which I did while I was working for a local Bay Area real estate company called Alon Pennell Realtors.
So I'm what the attracted you to the Marines? Are you a baby boomer? Was your dad in the military? Was it TV? I remember watching Steve Canyon when I was a kid and thinking, ah, the Air Force is for me.
That's great. So that's your Air Force Genesis story.
Yeah.
Mine is, I had an uncle that was a frogman when they were still called such a thing in the Marines. And he just cut this dashing figure that I really wanted to emulate. I had a granddad that saw Pacific service in the Navy during World War II. Mm-hmm. My dad was in the Army before.
Good. Okay, yeah, all right, you know, sizing up now. Yep.
Yeah. So it kind of felt like a family tradition I wanted to do. But I also had this sort of dueling drive to go build business, whatever that meant to a young, you know, young kid in college. And it turns out trying to balance those two things was pretty crazy, but I think the two shaped each other in a way. So a lot of the lessons I learned, you know, as a, you know, notional platoon leader, you know, and then, you know, later as a platoon sergeant, in a way, can help shape some of what you do in business.
So was Allen Pinnell, the Bay Area luxury real estate company, your first job after the Marines?
It wasn't. The crazy thing is, in a way, call it my continued education, since I kept following and tracking different types of marketing and sales companies. It was fascinating to me that someone could show up at your house with a clipboard, ask you a couple of questions about solar energy, and then later in that evening, a salesperson comes by, sells you $40,000 worth of solar, and that could all. I said, "That's like black magic. How does that happen?" And I was intensely interested in the mechanics of sales and marketing, and so this is very different to what, you know, the very abstract and academic way it was taught in school for me. So I was incredibly drawn to that. So I spent many years after college doing that, going to different companies, studying how they sold, taking it apart, putting it back together, finding out what the classic canonical steps are to selling. And that served me well my whole life.
We had this book that we used when I was at Apple called Hope is Not a Strategy.
I love that phrase.
Yeah, that refers to the idea of, in sales, you have to be a problem solver. You just can't hope that the customer will come around. You know, you have to be involved with a stakeholder, with a technical companion, with, and a problem solver with your customer. And when you do that, sales becomes the solution to the problem, not a burden. It's the answer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and because so many people, I mean, you see this so commonly, that say someone has more of a technical bent and they want to sell something to a customer, they'll then geek out on all the products, features, and specifications that interest them just completely blindly as to whether it's actually of use to a customer.
Yeah, do those features solve the pain point?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. If you align yourself to what the customer's trying to do, they surely don't want to fiddle with technical specs. They want to go do something. They want to go tell a story, make a TV show, make that easier. And that doesn't even feel like selling. You really feel like you're helping a customer. So
we got to move on. I want to move on to the next phase. This real estate company you worked with in the Bay Area, because you guys used a certain kind of computer that kind of led to the next step. So tell me about that.
Absolutely.
Pardon the pun.
Well, in the mid to late 90s, one of those companies I was working with in sales and marketing was a well-known local Bay Area luxury real estate company called Allen Pinnell Realtors. And they didn't look like any other real estate company you ever saw. They had.
You mean in buildings or in their organizational chart or their offices or what?
Absolutely everything. No expense spared in gorgeous Italian marble outfitting in the offices, in the advertising, extremely high end, you know, just acres of black ink, high end graphics, very much a lifestyle sort of company. And one thing they did differently that was light years ahead of its time was how they use technology. The first real estate company that I'm aware of that had email, a website. So when a CEO flush with cash with stock options walks in and sees your business card with an email address on it, he just sort of nods his head and says, "Yep, you get it." So wonderful company, but the computers they were using were Next workstations and Next cubes from a company called Next, headed by one Steve Jobs.
I'm beginning to see the connection here.
Well, and it was so as I increasingly started doing technology. So I spearheaded this thing where we shot video of a house and put it on our, you know, rather primitive.
Oh, those were the days. Made you feel like a magician.
Absolutely. And I got to fiddle with my own Sun Tower server that was literally sitting in the closet in the Alain Pennell office. Just heady days. But these computers were flat out amazing. Obviously, it had a radically different OS. It was Unix-like, but it was graphical. And, you know, the true acid test was real estate agents who were not very technical were using email that had their picture on it, and you couldn't take it away. You couldn't take it away from them. They loved it. And this blew my mind. This was a Unix OS display PostScript. And it was being used by everybody, and it really opened my eyes to what was possible and how special that OS was.
I got to use one at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory when I got there. It was a little on the old side, but it was pretty cool. And you got to remember that in 1991 or so, when did the Next system really hit its peak?
So 93?
93. In those days, basically, people were working with DOS and Mac OS 6 or something like that. So the Next system was very cool. And Steve made a big fuss about it and worked hard to bring it into enterprise. But the machine was so expensive and the development system was so exotic that people just kind of were frozen by the awesomeness of the technology and couldn't get their heads around it.
That's right. It's, you know, as expensive as they were, Alain Pennell realtors just bought them until they stopped making them. And it's true, as they transitioned away to software, I think it was actually a quad port at one time, x86, Spark, you know, it's like, talk about a heavy OS that has to run on all those different systems. But as when Steve came back to Apple, and it was pretty clear to me, knowing the Next internals and, you know, being recognized by Next as one of the largest customers, it became really clear to me how Apple was going to bridge this Mac OS to 64-bit OS. And I just had this flash of insight that I know that it's going to be based on Next, the OS. And in a way, it's almost a reverse intellectual takeover at Apple. So I said, you know what?
I've heard that phrase before. Yeah. You know, you got people like Bertrand Soleil and Bud Tribble and all those people at Next.
Oh,
it really was
Tavanian.
kind of a takeover of Apple's OS group by Next.
And
friendly,
it was
friendly though.
Amazing. Oh, very much so. It was just incredible technology. And I just had this flash that says, whatever it takes, I have to get to Apple, you know, in almost any capacity, you know.
Is there equal measure of reverence for Steve Jobs along with what he built, the Next system?
Yes, it was. I think in the Valley, there was a lot of sort of, I won't say skepticism. You know, I think the way Next was marketed as, you know, extremely high end, you know, very high end scientific researchers and education, that I think if you didn't use it and see its incredible potential, you would just dismiss it. And I think that's what a lot of people did.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about your life at Apple when we come back. That's going to be cool. But first, we have to take a commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us when I'm chatting with Skip Levins.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm talking to Backblaze Director of Product Marketing, Skip Levins. When did you join Apple? Trying to put it in perspective when I did.
Perfect. So in late 99, I started applying into Apple heavily because I saw this brilliant future and I wanted to be a part of it. And my first day was the first week of January 2000.
It was August of 2000 for me. So we really
run into
each other, I think, at about the same time.
So I was brought in to do something called Internet Partner Developer Outreach. And so imagine how you would develop for the internet on a Mac.
Using Mac TCP.
Or Mac OS 7. 7.
Yeah, that was the TCP stack. Remember? Mac TCP
right.
Was add-on. It was a glorious little widget.
So now that story changed really dramatically as you started as pre-release versions and developer versions of OS 10 started.
Oh, yeah, because then you had the BSD Ethernet stack.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that was when I got to know Monty Vidnus, developer of MySQL. And so there were all these developers rallying around this new OS that did a lot of really hard work to get their software to run on Mac OS X. Because before that, there were actually some well-regarded web servers on Mac OS 8 and Mac OS 9. And it turns out they were actually really secure because, you know, the typical vulnerabilities.
Oh, yeah. Mac HTTP. Yeah, from Chuck Shotton.
That's right.
I had Chuck on the show. He was great.
Oh, cool.
I was running Mac HTTP on a Quadra 700 back in those days at the Oak Ridge National Lab. And we had a bet because my friends were running Silicon Graphics machines. And they said, yeah, we can break in your Mac server. And I said, okay, I'll bet you lunch. And so they watched me and tried to wait until I made a mistake. And there's no ports open, and it's so dumb, and all it does is simple little things on port 80. So they put a packet sniffer on the network and waited for me to log on. They still couldn't catch me.
That's great.
You're right. That wasn't a very secure operating system because it didn't do much.
In fact, the U.S. Army ran one of their websites for years on Mac OS 9, just for that very reason.
Yeah, I remember those days. Yeah. So you were in developer relations, right? Reaching out, trying to get people who were interested in the Mac operating system to help them with software and evangelism.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, what's not well known about developer relations is that the evangelists that are outward bound really do take on an entire segment or cross section of users, and to build that segment and make opportunity for Apple. For something like internet developers, it was completely green field. So you'd have to go get the code editors. You'd have to go get the databases, the connectors, all these different pieces, and curate a mix of developers and software. And so I would produce CDs for several years that would have kind of a collection of all of this. But when Apple started to release or was making plans to release the XServe, that was a pivotal change. And
did the XServe come before the XServe RAID? Was it the other way around? I forget.
It did. The XServe was first, and the X-Serve RAID followed. And that server storage 1-2 combo was a complete game changer.
It was. For the listeners, the X-Serve was a Macintosh system rolled into a 1U rack server with special bells and whistles. The X-Serve RAID was a thicker device that had multiple drives and ran as a RAID 5 box, and it was glorious because of the software and the easy maintenance of it. And both these systems had big appeal in small business, right?
It really did. So I transitioned from being an internet developer relations to server and storage. Now, when you have both of those together, and then all of a sudden Apple had its own file system, XSAN, well, combine that with FileCut, and you set the stage to completely change how people do content creation, edit film and television.
I remember in those days there was a big fuss about television studios delivering real-time video off these RAID devices, and they were so excited.
It's true. You know, one of the unofficial sort of mottos of Apple is technology for the rest of us. And in those days, when film and television production seemed out of the reach of anyone, unless you were part of a big studio operation, one person or a few passionate filmmakers with a couple of Macs, you know, even the Brown, portables that Apple had, you could edit on those with Final Cut, all work together on an Apple-made server, Apple-made storage, Apple-made shared file system, and go toe-to-toe with any studio in the land. And it completely changed the world.
Now, this technology is sort of passed by the wayside. What do you attribute that to? Because Apple had a bright future in that area if they had continued to pursue it. But slowly they dropped the X-Serve RAID and then the X-Serve and just kind of got out of the business completely. Do you have any insights into why and then how the market reacted to that?
Well, these were really well-loved products and sold unbelievably well. So the X-Serve itself, so finally Apple had a 1U data center-friendly server, and it was used in schools and small businesses, and it was put together in giant racks to build supercomputers. Mm-hmm. And the storage sold so well, it was tracked in the traditional enterprise research companies that track top storage vendors. Well, we cracked the top four. We're talking building a business in the hundreds of millions of dollars, just a tiny little business on the rest of Apple. So this was really significant, a piece of business that was being built.
My perspective from my own viewpoint is that there were companies that were very good at doing this on a major corporate scale, companies like IBM and Silicon Graphics. And Apple had a tough time going up against these companies in government and corporations. It was really more focused towards small business. And the iPhone had not yet come along. This was not going to happen until 2007. So this is really all Apple had. They had the Macintosh, they had the servers and storage, and the only thing Apple could do without the iPhone and the iPad was to pursue these kinds of Unix technologies. But in time, my perspective is that the iPhone just sort of blew up and took over. Apple felt like there was not big money to be made in these areas. What do you think?
Yeah, that's really true. So it's interesting, you know, the currency at Apple, and this is unique to any company I've ever known, the currency isn't what's in the bank. It is the developers, the engineers internally, and what they're working on. So I'm not speaking for anyone, but imagine the opportunity cost if someone says, well, let's say X-Serve RAID are going to need 20 engineers. And for the work they could do to build whatever the next generation of X-Serve and X-Serve RAID look like, what if instead they built this new product that I think will have an 800x impact with an iPhone. So that's easy math. And again, I'm not speaking for anyone, but that's really the kind of calculus that was in consideration. And for whatever reason, you know, personally, I believe that, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. How great would it have been to keep Xserve and Xserve Grid going and do iPhone? But clearly a decision was taken to let's take this currency that is unique to Apple, can't use anywhere else, and let's put it on iPhone.
I think the same thing happened with supercomputers. There was an explosion when Virginia Tech, in I think 2002, roughly built a supercomputer system with over 1,000 Xservs tied it together with
InfiniBand.
InfiniBand, right. Yeah.
So and, you may not know, that was my project.
Yeah, you mentioned that before the meeting. Yeah.
So
you got to know Serenity or Adagiron.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So here's the story for that. So, you know, to set the picture, Apple is getting all these great wins. You, for example, were out there doing all this great stuff with science and research institutions. And, you know, we were getting all these wins and software coming over to OS X and the Xserve getting great adoption. And then at WWDC 2003, for this show, mind you, I had been asked to put together for the first time an enterprise track for Apple's content at WWDC, something Apple had never done before. So I produced this track, you know, wrangled the speakers, you know, helped with content, just this massive, you know, 20 plus hour a day effort for weeks. Then in Steve's keynote, he announces the Silver Tower Max with this new chip, the Power Mac G5, and the partnership with IBM.
Oh, and people, yeah. Power Mac G5, cheese grater. Awesome, yeah. Computer. Awesome. I still have one.
Fantastic. Well, hang on to it because it's a workhorse.
Yeah.
Well, so right as the show was closing and I was thinking, wow, I could really use some well-deserved rest. They said, Skip, I want to introduce you to someone called Dr. Varadarajan, who's a professor at Virginia Tech. And he is an expert at designing supercomputer architectures. He's going to build one on Power Mac G5s.
Yeah, that was the initial cut because the Xserve wasn't ready yet. And so, can you imagine a rack-mounted vertical Power Mac G5 on racks and 1,000 of them? It didn't last very long because they quickly replaced it with Xservers, right?
Absolutely. But here's the kicker. So we had just announced this. There were barely any models to demo, let alone go develop all the core software and system management tools you needed to port to be able to go build this. And the goal was insanely ambitious. It was within a matter of a couple of weeks, have enough of a proof of concept running on enough Power Macs that Apple can provide to qualify for inclusion on that year's top 500 supercomputer list by Dr. Jack Dongara.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was like moonshot crazy ambitious. And
yeah, we're on the sales side. We were working side by side with you on that.
Absolutely.
And we had all sorts of inquiries from Los Alamos. We'd go to supercomputing, set up a booth at supercomputing, people come by and visit, look at our systems and start imagining what they could do. It was great.
Those were heady days. So, so obviously we got that first test done, did a gigantic run to record results for the top 500 list and placed as the third fastest supercomputer in the world, powered by Apple Power Mac G5s. It was unbelievably heady days.
What happened after that, though, was kind of sad. Apple didn't understand how to market supercomputers. Apple understood how to market cool little gadgets like iPods, and they knew how to create jazz on the consumer level. Mm-hmm. But when it came to selling supercomputers, you had PhD scientists at national laboratories who were very capable and very well-researched, and they expected a lot, and you had to work them and wine them and dine them and develop a relationship. It's like that Hope is Not a Strategy book we were talking about.
Right.
And you had to become a technical partner for many years. I remember at Supercomputing 2003 in Phoenix, I think, or it was 2004 in Pittsburgh, that Apple really got into supercomputing and set up a giant booth and had a giant video screen and was really pushing things. And they had this customer feedback ticket system where people could fill out their name and say, hey, I'm interested in Apple's a supercomputer supplier. Send me information. Have a salesman call on me and drop it in the bucket. Well, that's not the way computer scientists work. So it takes years of building relationships. And so when they opened up the jar, after having spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this booth, the jar was virtually empty because that's not the way computer scientists work. They don't buy a $5 million supercomputer like they buy an iPod. So Apple kind of got soured on that because they didn't really know how to reach out. And I spent a lot of time trying to do that, but Apple headquarters didn't approach the market that way. It was a lot easier for executives at Apple to whip up a fervor with great video ads shown on TV and get people, you know, lining up to come into the retail stores. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to supercomputing.
Yes. I mean, it was at the time. So the way it was communicated to me was, yes, you have blessing to go do this, but kind of with a sense of like, well, we don't know if it'll work. So, you know, you're kind of on your own if you can pull this off. And then when it became so successful and was picked up by a lot of the news outlets, written up in Wired, it became a bit of a phenomenon. And it was sort of sent back down to me that like, yeah, love the promotion, love the news. But you're right. I don't think that translated to a willingness to do year over year steady marketing to, as you say, these people need to know that you're going to be there. And it could take years for them to push a program through.
And a couple companies were especially good at that. Cray and SGI and IBM understood that. I took an Apple executive around the floor at Supercomputing 2004 in Pittsburgh, and they were blown away. And one of them looked at me and said, we can't compete with that. Well, we got to move on.
Yeah.
All right. So we only have a few minutes left, and there's a lot to talk about. Tell me about your evolution in storage. You've worked for several notable storage companies. I think Active Storage was the first, or was it Quantum?
It was Active Storage was first. You know, when we left the story off with Exerve Raid that was, quietly dropped at Apple, there was still such a following. And, you know, storage combined with Xsan, Apple's shared file system, to this day, still included with every copy of OS X, there was such a following that myself and the father of Exerve Raid, Alex Grossman, did a startup and said, you know what, let's go build out what the rest of that vision looks like. And that's exactly what we did. We built storage perfectly adapted for the Xsan file system and kept that vision and continued to build out.
I remember those days. That was great. We all thought, wow, this is great. Apple may have dropped the Xserve Raid, but Active Storage is carrying on the flag. It's so great.
That was exactly right. Those two were heady days, and it was a tremendous learning experience, learning how to build a startup. When there's no one, there's just only a few people around the table, you know, everybody gets to do something, and that was both exhilarating and terrifying. Even then, you could tell though that the way people use storage for content production, film and television production, was starting to shift and became much more complicated than just a, you know, let's build you an Xsan environment.
So I don't know if you want to get into details, but Active Storage got into a little bit of trouble. And then you and Alex went off, Alex Grossman, who was the father of the Xserve Raid at Apple, you two went off with others and formed Simply.
That's right. Active Storage wound down Following that, I and a few other people went and joined Quantum. Quantum are the makers of the StoreNext file system that works, interoperates with the XAND file system. So that was a way, in a way, if you can follow the thread, to keep that going with XAND users. So I drove technical marketing for Quantum for a few years. And the startup bug bit again. So it was off to go do a startup again with Alex Grossman called Simply.
Alex Grossman is an amazing fellow, by the way. I've had him on the show. Listeners, if you get a chance to go back and listen to that one, you'll hear a great voice and a great mind talk about storage.
Absolutely.
Along with you, Skip.
Thank you kindly. The approach at Simply was to kind of go from big servers and storage in a rack to answer the question of what does storage look like if it's super fast, on Thunderbolt, and directly connected to one or maybe a few computers. So that was sort of the other end of the spectrum. And since Simply and doing some consulting of my own, I've then joined Backblaze to answer this next question, which is how is cloud changing and answering how is cloud answering how filmmakers and content producers want to work today? So
I want to take a few minutes and explore that. I mean, when we first heard about cloud storage, it was kind of slow compared to the size of the files we had. And people were concerned about loss of connectivity. Things have changed a lot. We've got a lot faster internet speeds. It's not unusual for a home to have 50 or 100 megabits per second, although not everybody has. There are some people in rural areas that, you know, are still stuck with 1.5 to 5. But in general, residential, at least in my experience with Comcast, 50 megabits per second is easy in a residential environment. And now you can start thinking about realistic cloud backups, right?
Absolutely. So to relate that to, you know, say a small post-production house that cuts films or trailers. So in days past, there were no two bones about it. You have very fast local storage. And that's it. You have a couple of users all using shared storage, and cloud was maybe used as a place to share the result of that file.
Right.
And today, customers look at that and say, well, the cloud is starting to fit in lots of different places. So maybe I can't do away with that ultra-fast storage right next to my editing stations, but everything else is really up for grabs. As you say, cloud for one thing, it's extremely robust by definition, the way the storage is actually built. So things that you'd be vulnerable to were it sitting in a data center, like a power to a whole rack goes, drives go. That's a consideration you don't have in cloud. So if, let's say, I'm shooting, I come back from the field, I want to probably make a copy of the data cards I just shot on, but I can start moving those to the cloud right away. So if my camera gets run over, it's all in the cloud. And guess what? It's in the cloud. People can start pulling it in and editing it right away.
Is data in Backblaze cloud encrypted on the disks?
Yes. It is encrypted. And in fact, you have to have very secure access to the storage. And then if someone were somehow able to intercept, say, some of these data objects flying around, they'd be unintelligible. They'd be of completely no use.
Excellent.
So you can very closely control who has access to what parts of storage. So today, people are using it to be the target of everything you archive. So say you're a TV show and you have lots of high resolution images and trailers and such. Well, they take up a lot of space on the storage you use to edit, but it's a perfect place to move them off of that And since it's the cloud, it just expands infinitely to be as large as you want. And you don't have to pay a big bill to buy it up front. So it really has made tremendous inroads and changed how people do content production.
Well, I wish we could continue on. I have a few more things I wanted to ask you about, but now we're really, really out of time. Maybe you have to come back on the show and we'll talk about Macintoshes and supercomputers some more. How's that sound?
My pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining me on the show. This has been a fantastic discussion. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
I'm really easy. Skip@backblaze.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Folks, I hope you enjoyed the show, even though we ran a little long. It was really a lot of fun. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode with Skip Levins. We'll see you again next week.